his story, the way he grew up, really inspires me. It really, you know, moves me.
Alaskans rally for Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 25th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, discouraging data on Alaska's youngest residents.
While it looks like we have relatively few children living in poverty, that doesn't give the complete picture.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Among the thousands of Americans gathering in Denver, Colorado for this week's Democratic National Convention are more than 70 Alaskans. 20 are voting delegates. APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent Libby Casey reports.
The Alaskan delegates have one thing in common. They're big supporters of Barack Obama. Some relate to him personally, like 18-year-old Andres Chauville, who's an immigrant from Colombia.
His story, the way he grew up, really inspires me. It really, you know, moves me. It kind of relates to my story. The reason I believe in him is because he believes in us.
Chauville is just old enough to vote this year and credits Obama with inspiring him to become politically active. He's from Chugiak and will also be representing the Latino and youth votes. Another young Alaskan attending as a delegate, 24-year-old Idris Okunchebi, is also an immigrant from Nigeria. He's proud of Obama's African roots. The candidate's father was from Kenya.
He embodies the American dream, you know. Wasn't born with a silver spoon.
Okunchebi is a veteran. He was stationed at Anchorage Army Post Fort Richardson and spent 16 months in the war zone of Iraq. Barack Obama is against the war, but Okunchebi supports it. However, the veteran says it's Obama's courage of conviction that attracts him. He respects Obama even more for speaking out against the war when it was unpopular to do so. And Okunchebi hopes to someday tell his children about being part of history and helping to elect the first African-American president into office. One Alaskan with a front-row seat this week is Holly Stiebing. The 21-year-old Inupiaq from Anchorage is a college student and was selected to meet Obama backstage before his acceptance speech.
When she called and said she was from the headquarters in Chicago, I just screamed. And then she kind of laughed and she said to calm down. And I was just so surprised. I couldn't even believe it.
Stiebing says she believes Obama cares about Native rights, increasing funding for Indian health services, and is concerned about the high levels of violence against Native women. When Stiebing meets him, she hopes to describe the living conditions in some Alaskan villages where families still use honey buckets.
Something needs to change because, like, if we have, you know, Alaska Native people, you know, American people who are living like that, who don't have running water and who don't have sewage or sanitation, that's really upsetting. And then another issue that's just kind of a big issue in Alaska is, you know, opening up ANWR. I'd like to talk to him about the overall sentiment of the state. And also, I'd like to talk about possibly looking into more renewable resources and what his ideas would be for Alaska in terms of renewable resources.
Even Alaskans in Denver who were Hillary Clinton supporters a few months ago say they're behind Obama. State Democratic Party Chairwoman Patty Higgins is one of about 850 superdelegates in the nation, meaning that she can vote as she chooses, not as a representative of a district. She was committed to Clinton, but says as soon as Clinton endorsed Obama, she chose to support him too. Higgins attended a previous convention, but says this one is different. She says there is an electricity in the air that Democrats haven't felt since John F. Kennedy accepted the nomination 48 years ago.
Everybody is just so excited. There's this feeling of hope and optimism. There's this incredible energy by young people, and they are just mobilizing and being active, and it's just impressive.
And there's even an Alaskan Republican in Denver this week. Fairbanks Mayor Jim Whitaker is being billed by the Obama campaign as a prominent Republican who's supporting him. Whitaker's caught some flack from members of his party, but says he's unfazed by criticism.
I am still a Republican. I, though, am an American first, and I reserve the right to vote for the individual that I think will best serve America. And I have no qualms about discussing that publicly.
Whitaker will deliver a short speech at the convention Tuesday night. He says it's time for an improvement in America's foreign economic and energy policies, and he believes Obama's the person to lead the way.
I think, firstly, he has significant intellectual capability. I think he is a pragmatist, but still retains idealism. When you combine intellect with pragmatic idealism, there is an opportunity to make wise decisions. And hopefully those wise decisions will be manifested in good public policy.
It will be months before Alaskans find out if this enthusiasm translates into votes back home for Obama. Alaska has only chosen a Democratic presidential candidate once, and that was Lyndon Johnson more than 40 years ago. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
The annual Kids Count Alaska data book has been released, and it continues to show some alarming trends. KBBI's Mike Mason reports.
The annual Kids Count Alaska data book covers the 2006-2007 school year and was prepared by the University of Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research. It includes data on the economic system, the economic well-being of kids, and the number of kids who end up in the juvenile justice system. The project director for Kids Count Alaska is Virgene Hanna, who's been leading the project since 2001. She wants Alaskans who examine the data book to keep a couple of things in mind.
While it looks as if we don't have many children living in poverty, the federal poverty line is the same across all states. There's no difference, no allowance made for the cost of living in Alaska, which is much higher in rural Alaska than probably any other place in the country. So people need to be aware that while it looks like we have relatively few children living in poverty, that doesn't give the complete picture.
Nationally, it's estimated that 19% of children live at or below the poverty line. In Alaska, the number of kids in poverty increased from 11% in 2004 to 15% in 2005. Kids Count Alaska is part of a larger nationwide program that's sponsored by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. The data book for Alaska covers the roughly 206,000 children, 18 or younger, who live in the state of Alaska. An interesting fact outlined in the data book is that boys outnumber girls in Alaska by close to 6%. In fact, there are more boys than girls in every age group. One of the alarming trends outlined in the data book is the graduation rate in Alaska. Hanna characterized the rate as dismal.
We include in the data book one measure that's comparable across the U.S., so you can compare Alaska with all the other states, and only about two-thirds of Alaska's high school students graduate, compared with three-quarters nationally.
According to the data book, in 2006, fewer than half of Alaskan Native and Black seniors, just over half of the Hispanic seniors, and 60% of the Asian and Pacific Island seniors graduated. The graduation rate for white students is 68%. Hanna says the lack of high school graduates and the large number of dropouts will have some long-term implications for the state of Alaska.
We'll be unable to have a skilled, prepared workforce ready to compete if we don't have higher high school graduation rates. And even among those who graduate, we have a lower percentage in Alaska that go on to college than among other states.
Another section of the Kids Count Alaska data book covers the economic well-being of children. One of the indicators are children in households where no parent has full-time year-round employment. In Alaska, 41% of children fell into that category. However, it should be noted that Alaska has traditionally had a very seasonal economy, and Alaska has the highest seasonal variation in workers in the country. Hanna says the biggest drawback for children from the seasonal economy is a lack of health insurance opportunities.
Temporary work, like we have in mining, construction, seafood industries in Alaska, means that these folks aren't eligible or aren't offered health insurance. So the whole family suffers.
In Alaska, 15% of the children without a parent employed full-time year-round don't have health insurance. Among all children in Alaska, roughly 10% don't have health insurance. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sitkins celebrate a new state park.
You know, we've got plenty of sidewalks in town, but nothing like this, where you can go and walk for miles and have nature and ocean.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. APRN would like to thank Northern Air Cargo for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
Alaska state troopers have busted one of their own. Trooper Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Enforcement, in conjunction with the State Drug Enforcement Administration, has charged Fairbanks-based Trooper Scott Eday with forging prescriptions. Colonel Audie Holloway, director of the Alaska State Troopers, says officers were tipped to Eday's actions.
We had an investigation caused by some information being given to us by a pharmacist that led us to find out that one of our troopers had seemed to have committed prescription fraud.
Eday is accused of forging prescriptions for narcotic pain medication on four separate occasions last winter and spring. Trooper Eday told investigators he needed the drugs for an injury he suffered while in the Army. Colonel Holloway says there's no indication that Eday took the medication while on duty. He calls the case extremely unusual and serious.
He is charged with a felony, so it depends on what the judge decides to do on that, but that's usually something over a year in jail.
Holloway says Eday has been suspended for some time, but could not otherwise comment on his employment due to personnel confidentiality. Eday has been a trooper since 2004. He served in Palmer prior to transferring to Fairbanks in January of this year. The U.S. Mint began circulating the Alaska State Quarter today. The coin has an image of a grizzly with a salmon in its jaws, along with the saying, "The Great Land." 500 million of the quarters will be minted over the next 10 weeks. It's part of a 10-year program to commemorate each state in the order they entered the Union. Alaska's quarter will have a ceremonial kickoff this Friday at the State Fair in Palmer. U.S. Mint Deputy Director Andy Brunhart will be on hand for that. He says the celebration starts at 1 p.m.
Governor Palin will be there, Senator Murkowski, Mayor Menard. We'll have a introductory ceremony. We'll have the 50 states on a map, and ceremonially we'll attach the Alaska State Quarters to the map, with leaving only one space to go. At that point, we will hand out to every child 18 or under their own free, brand new, straight from the Mint Alaska State Quarters. And right after that ceremony, anybody can purchase rolls of quarters at face value, a roll of quarters, 40 quarters for $10, and be amongst the first to have their state quarter.
And so how are new state quarters distributed? Is there an effort to get these into circulation in Alaska as soon as possible, or do they? How is it that they go out?
All state quarters are distributed the same way. They go from the Mint to the Federal Reserve System throughout the whole nation. And the Federal Reserve distributes them to their providers and then to the banks. The banks order them upon demand and they're delivered. What in practice happens, of course, we have a ceremonial launch, and that brings a few thousand to the state. But at each state, the request to the banks, once the quarters go into circulation, gets very high. So in practice, what happens is a lot of quarters are vectored to the new state launch in that state.
How did the idea come about to start making state quarters in the first place?
Well, actually, it all went back as an idea from Congress in 1997. They passed a public law, the 50 State Commemorative Coin Program Act. It directed us to launch this program. We launched it in 1999, the 50 State Quarter Program. It's been a 10-year program with five quarters per year. And, of course, Alaska is the 49th quarter.
Alaska and Hawaii are, of course, at the end of the line for the state quarter series. Does the U.S. Mint have plans for future quarter designs, other ideas?
Well, actually, the very next step after Hawaii is that the Congress determined and decided that we would commemorate the District of Columbia and the U.S. territories in 2009. So actually, in 2009, there'll be 6 quarter launches for our 5 territories in the District of Columbia. And then we'll come to the end of that program. The Congress is currently contemplating 2 other programs, one of which is a national park program, which is a NASA program, but the statute hasn't been passed yet. And so we at the Mint implement what Congress passes by law.
Andy Brunhart is Deputy Director of the U.S. Mint. The Alaska Municipal League Legislative Committee and the Alaska Conference of Mayors are holding their summer meeting in Wrangell, August 27th and 28th. Up to 65 people from throughout the state are expected to attend. KSTK's Lisa Fu reports.
The Alaska Municipal League is an organization that serves as an advocacy group for its members. The League's members are 140 cities, boroughs, and unified municipalities throughout the state. Kathy Wasserman is the executive director of AML.
We lobby the state legislature and the federal government for, in regards to bills and statutes and regulations that might affect the Alaska cities and boroughs and how they govern and how it affects their residents.
During their summer legislative meeting, Wasserman says AML cements priorities for the upcoming legislative session.
What issues are we going to work on? What issues have floated to the top during the last session that we perhaps either didn't accomplish or have to move on to look at this coming year?
Wasserman predicts what will be on the forefront of everyone's minds.
This year they will be mostly dealing with energy because every city and borough in the state has energy issues that they have to cope with. And the other one will be transportation needs.
While the participants will be addressed as a large group, most of the meetings will be conducted in smaller groups.
Different people there have different expectations. They have different expertise. Obviously, we have a lot of coastal communities that are very concerned about ferry service, while the interior communities are concerned about roads.
Steve Hagenson, the state's energy coordinator and executive director of Alaska Energy Authority, is scheduled to talk. The next meeting of the Alaska Municipal League is the 58th Annual Local Government Conference taking place in Ketchikan this November, and AML's winter legislative meeting is being held in Juneau in January. This is Lisa Fu, reporting in Wrangell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Two young boys who capsized a canoe in chilly ocean waters near Angoon earlier this month are doing fine. Injury prevention specialists credit a pair of loaner life jackets from the statewide Kids Don't Float program for saving the boys' lives. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
It's the kind of scenario that gives parents chills. One moment, kids are playing happily in Whaler's Cove. The next, there's panic as non-swimmers are tipped into the 50-degree water.
He said the difference between the happy laughter and the fear scream and just shocked you. I mean, one minute they're happy, and next minute everybody's yelling and hollering.
Jennifer Young lives in Sitka but hails from Angoon. A lot of her family lives there, including her grown son Jeff, a cook at the Angoon Senior Center, who called and described the events to her. Young says that Jeff and another adult ran down the beach and swam out to the boys.
One of the boys couldn't swim and was just panicking. That's all he kept yelling was, "I don't know how to swim." So my son swam out to these two young boys and was calming them down because they had the life jackets on. the one boy didn't know how to swim, was really afraid.
Jennifer Young works in the Injury Prevention Office of SEARCH, the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Young says that when her son called to tell her about the rescue of the two boys, she was thrilled to hear that they were wearing life jackets at all. But Jeff added one important detail.
And Mom, it'll make you very happy to know that on back of the vest, it said Kids Don't Float.
SEARCH is a regional partner in Kids Don't Float, a joint program of the state and Coast Guard, now in its 10th year. According to the state section of Injury Prevention and Emergency Medical Services, the program has spent $300,000 on life vests at 450 locations around the state. The rescue of the two boys in Angoon are the 15th and 16th confirmed saves for Kids Don't Float. Joe McCullough, the education coordinator with the State Office of Boating Safety, says that among all the variables that can affect whether someone survives a capsize, wearing a life jacket is the most important.
They panic, they don't know how to swim, they gasp for air. I mean, everything was just all haywire. But they were able to maintain their airway because they had a life jacket on. They throw the same two kids in the water without a life jacket on. Same thing happens. They gasp for air, they aspirate water, and they drown. And that's the difference.
McCullough says Alaska is rewriting the book on cold water survival, both through the Kids Don't Float Loner Life Jacket program and its companion online education curriculum, and through the efforts of partners like SEARCH and the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. He believes upward of 50,000 school-age kids have had some cold water immersion training, and just having the knowledge of knowing what to expect, like a fire drill, increases their chances of survival. McCullough says he spent 20 years busting the myth that there's no point to wearing a life jacket in the cold waters of Alaska.
There were a lot of dinosaurs, if you will, or urban myths that were getting perpetuated. The life jacket's only for body recovery.
McCullough says that roughly 9 out of 10 people who accidentally drown in the state aren't wearing life jackets. Jennifer Young says there was a boating safety training in Angoon recently, but she doesn't know if the boys or their families participated. Angoon has seen its share of tragedy. She's glad this story had a happy ending.
Because when you lose one person, the whole community mourns. It was a good feeling. Good feeling to know that there wouldn't be sad families.
The Kids Don't Float Loner Life Jacket Board is located at the top of the floatplane dock in Angoon and in similar locations in most harbors in Alaska. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Fort Rousseau Causeway State Historical Park was recently dedicated in Sitka, becoming the newest state park in the Alaska system in 11 years. As KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports, the park will appeal not only to those interested in Sitka's trail system, but also in its history dating back to World War II.
We can turn right onto Sesedny Island here, and this is the old road before the trail works.
Matthew Hunter does not look old enough to be a World War II expert, but at the age of 25, he spent more than half his life researching Sitka's involvement in that war, from its outlooks on Harbor Mountain to the Harbor Defenses Project on the Causeway.
The Army needed a place to put their base because the Navy had taken over all of Japonski Island, so they chose the string of islands to be their garrison for the harbor defenses that they built to defend the air station from sea attack by the Japanese.
5 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor, authorization was given to connect the string of islands between Japonski and McNaughty Islands. Today, the bunkers that housed soldiers and fuses, as well as artillery, are part of the area's history.
You can see in front of us one of the 3-inch anti-aircraft gun emplacements that were built in early 1942. And if we walk up to it and you look at the concrete, you can see the names of, or at least one of the names of the guys who built it. But it says Sergeant, it looks like Don Mill or something like that, M-I-L-L-E. So I've got some lists of servicemen here, and I'm going to see if I can look them up.
Three ammo magazines, which house the artillery separate from the gun batteries, are located on Varublanoi Islands, just a short walk from the fuse house and two-story bunker on Sesedny, which Hunter says was probably a radio station. There's a big turnout for the dedication ceremony, and as a fire blazes and the rain beats down, curious Sitkins check out the inside of one artillery magazine. It's dank and mildewed inside and kind of creepy, but Sitka resident Peggy Reeves is inspired by the acoustics. Reeves is also inspired by the network of trails, about 8,000 feet, that link the seven islands of the Causeway, which make up Alaska's newest state park.
I hope that it will get more people walking. You know, we've got plenty of sidewalks in town, but nothing like this, where you can go and walk for miles and have nature and ocean and not worry about hills or steps.
Fort Rousseau and the Causeway have been in the public eye for a long time. Deborah Lyons, executive director of Sitka Trailworks, says generally most people are in favor of this project, but certain issues have come up.
There are concerns that members of Sitka's Native community have brought up about graves that may be out here and the treatment of graves that were here when the Army, you know, blasted through these islands.
Lyons says a lot of people who grew up in Sitka played here as children.
One lady told me, I used to play with my dollies in that two-story bunker, you know, so it used to be very accessible, and there's a lot of old-time Sitkans who really support restoring the area and restoring access to the area.
I was amazed at the trees, how tall they are.
And there's people like Dorothy Thompson, known as Brownie, who says she hasn't been out here at all since before the airport was built.
One thing I always remembered was the, I guess you call it watchtower at the end. It was, someone said today is 60 feet, but I know there were a lot of steps up to it. But the view was terrific. And, of course, I was young then. And I always thought that would have been a great place to fix it so you could live there.
At least for now, Alaska's newest state park is accessible only by boat. But judging by the turnout for the dedication, it's well worth the effort. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason and Homer, Lisa Fu and Wrangell, Dan Bross and Fairbanks, and Robert Woolsey and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Meneker. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
Attention voters! Tuesday, August 26th is primary election day. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, call 1-888-383-8683 or in Anchorage 269-8683. For additional information or other accommodations, please contact the Division of Elections at 907-465-4611, TTY TDD 907-465-3020. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.